Second line, Tan Rabbanon Hadon Chaver Lekaf Zchus Danan Oso Lezchus. So there's a special reward for someone who judges another person favorably, who gives the benefit of the doubt to others that he is also Danan Oso Lezchus. Other people, he will also be judged with the same favor. Now, there's the Sfas Emes brings two different explanations as to what this is referring to. Does it mean that Hashem will judge him favorably, or does it mean that other people will judge him favorably? So maybe we'll revisit that a little bit at the end if there's time. But I personally like to operate with the latter notion that when a person has that good midah of judging other people favorably, so Hashem rewards him. The Maharal says midah keneged midah. You know, literally, the same way that you judge people, Hashem will judge you as well. I think that's actually explicit in our benching. We say, "Bamarom yilamdu alehem ve'aleinu zuchus." That, you know, to be malamid zuchus, it's an expression that says, you know, to find a justification, to find an understanding when something that we see appears to be incorrect or an improper behavior, we daven, "Bamarom yilamdu alehem." It may be so, "Bamarom" means upon high, that in Shemayim they should look at us with the same favorable judgment that we are supposed to have for other people. Okay. Ma'isa ba'adam echad. Following story occurred with an anonymous person. That anonymous person, we learn from the Shiltos, Rav Achoy Gon, was actually Rabbi Kiva. Okay? So maybe I should have told you that later. Okay, I don't want to spoil the story, but he's left anonymous at the moment. So he lived up north, and he went down towards the south from the Galil. And he worked for a specific Baal Bayis. We know who that person is also, but I'm not going to give away anything yet. In the south for 3 years. 3 years. And the 3 years concluded Erev Yom Kippur. Now, just as an aside, 3 years is not a coincidental amount of time that he's working, because the Gemara is about to say that he's going to go home, that his term of labor concluded on Yom Kippur after 3 years. So the Mordechai, I believe it's in Bava Metzia, maybe Bava Basra, the Mordechai says that we actually derive a halacha that one is not supposed to. It's in Bava Metzia. He's not supposed to hire himself out for more than 3 years. More than 3 years. Why? Because the Torah talks at length about, you know, you can have someone, an employee, a worker, right? That's a sachir. And then you have another construct, you have another category called an eved ivri, who's like an indentured servant. Now, an eved ivri, we know, sometimes gets sold into slavery if he steals money and can't pay it back. And if he wants to stay, then we pierce his ear. That's in Parshas Mishpatim, right? That's the eved ivri. But Chazal tells us eved ivri is really not an ideal setup. In fact, in that context, it's Hashem says, avodai heim, right? Klal Yisrael are my avadim. Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. They are my avadim. Avadai heim v'lo avadim l'avadim. They are meant to be my servants and not supposed to serve anybody else. So being an Eved Ivri, even though there's a halachic framework for it, is not really, you know, what God had in mind, that one Jew should enslave another. So what is the threshold? What is the point at which you become an Eved as opposed to just being an employee? So some say we learn from here 3 years is the maximum. Why? Because an Eved Ivri is 6 years. And the Torah refers to that 6 year tour of duty as Mishneh Schar Sachir. Mishneh means twice, double, like Mishneh, right? Lecha Mishneh, right? Mishneh Torah. So Mishneh Schar Sachir, the double of the employment of a Sachir, of a hired worker, is 6 years, implying that 3 years is under that threshold and appropriate for a person to hire himself out. Okay? Obviously, it's not the same as we have nowadays, where you know, you could have the same job for 30, 40 years, but as a paid worker like this day to day, this is where we draw the line. I have to know how to differentiate between what we have nowadays, not our discussion right now. So Erev Yom Kippur comes, and obviously he wasn't going to work on Yom Kippur, so this was his day to say goodbye and go back to his family, which implies that he had been away from his family for 3 years, which is really amazing. Amar lo tein li schari. So he says, please give me these 3 years of wages, and let me go home, and I'm going to support my wife and my children. Amar lo, ein li mos, I have no money. Okay, amar lo, tein li peiros. So if you don't have any cash, that's okay. Just give me some fruit, give me some produce. Amar lo, ein li, I don't have that either. So he says, okay, tein li karka. So then give me some real estate. Give me some land to take the place of the cash that you owe me. Because, you know, whatever you're able to pay me is acceptable, and I'll take it. Okay? But apparently that's not going to work either. Ainley, he says, I don't have any... What's that?
How does the karka help him getting back to his family?
That's a good question. It could be, you know, you'll see some other examples of what he asked for because the story's not over yet. We would imagine that either that gives him some equity to go borrow money quickly, okay? Gives him some, you know, something in the bank or something that he could sell and turn into cash. You know, he might not be able to get the... 100%. Look, obviously, it would put him at a disadvantage, right? If he had to sell it fast, he's going to have to get a lower price for it. But he's desperate to get anything. Doesn't want to go home. It's a long way home also, right? It's interesting. Wherever he was in the Galil HaElyon, to travel from the Darom, you know, whatever point on Erev Yom Kippur, didn't leave him a lot of time. But you can go with my first pshat. Could be the first pshat is correct, that he could borrow money easily once he has some real estate, okay? Now, to give away a little more of the... you know, hopefully without spoiling too much, Rabbi Akiva, this is Rabbi Akiva before he was Rabbi Akiva. This was when he was just simply Akiva ben Yosef. And we know from the stories in the Gemara that Rabbi Akiva, before his rise to fame, was destitute. He had no money. And his wife sent him off to yeshiva. Apparently this is even before that happened. Okay, so he was ready to take anything he could, but he definitely couldn't borrow any money if he didn't have any real estate to mortgage or to borrow against. Okay, so he has no karka, ainli. Tainli behema, so I'll take an animal. Ainli. Tainli karam ksasos, give me pillows, give me blankets, something. Ainli. So he says, I have nothing to offer you. Hivshil kelev lachorov, v'halach lebesu b'pachin nefesh. So he throws his stuff over his shoulder, packs up, and he goes home, b'pachin nefesh, very depressed and very forlorn. Okay, so that's the end of part one of the story. So he didn't have anything to pay him, and he went home hungry. We don't know how he fed his family after that, but we can imagine what it was like for him to come home, you know, nothing to show for it after 3 years. L'achar regel, so we're talking about a week and a half, 2 weeks later, after Yom Kippur and after Sukkot, evidently. Okay. Notel ba'albayis schoro biyado, v'imo maso gimu chamorim. So he the ba'albayis. Baal Bayis, who we can now identify as Rebbe Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Rebbe Elazar ben Hyrcanus was a very wealthy man. He was also the great Tana, Rebbe Elazar. We know a few things about him, but we'll save that for later. So not the Baal Bayis, Schar B'Yadah. We definitely, you know, should note the fact that whatever he's doing, his choices in this story are legitimate choices. You know, he was a halachic authority in his own right. Therefore we can make medayik, we can infer practical halacha from some of the things he did. So not of Alvayas Schar B'Yado, he has a lot of cash for whatever it is that he owes Rabbi Akiva from working for all those years. The imo maso gimel chamor, and he also takes along 3 donkeys carrying all kinds of extra things. Echad shel Michael, echad shel Mishna, echad shel Minim Megadim. One donkey is holding food, one is holding drinks, and the other one, mini megadim, all kinds of other treats and delicacies. Okay? V'halach lo lebeso, and he goes to Rabbi Akiva's house. Acher sha'achlu v'shasu, after they ate and they drank, nosan lo scharo, then he pays him his wages. Okay? So now before we get to the point of the story that the Gemara wants to focus on, right off the bat, you have a very interesting problem. What do you think the problem is? Does anything seem suspect about what Rabbi Elazar just did when he came to pay the wages to Rabbi Akiva? Sorry to put you on the spot. Yes.
Probably.
Okay. Very good. So the Achronim asked that question. What's going on, Rabbi Elazar? He was a Tana. He knew his stuff. How could he go and not just pay back the wages, right? Natal Schar B'Yado. He brought the wages that he owed Rabbi Akiva, but he also brought him a truckload of stuff. He brought him food and drinks and all this bonus pay. And under normal circumstances, we would imagine that that's Ribbis.
Well, was it Ribbis on the salary, or was it because Rabbi Akiva was so nice to him and not hit him over the head? So when he left,
So since Rabbi Akiva was so nice, he was giving him a present. Why does it have to be ribbis?
Okay, very good question. Very good question. So let me make a few points, and hopefully I'll cover that point. But I think it doesn't mean that you're off. I think the answer is important. There is one of the Rishonim, Rabbi Elazar Mitoch, one of the French Rishonim, quoted in the Beis Yosef in Shulchan Aruch, who says you can actually derive from here that there is no prohibition of ribbis on wages. Okay, meaning let's just backtrack a little bit. Ribbis is it's a world unto itself, but the Torah explicitly talks about a prohibition to lend someone money. Here, I'm giving you $100. Next week, pay me back $120. That is absolutely forbidden midoraisa. Very, very serious consequences. Let's say that's not exactly the case. Let's say I lend $100, and we never made any terms of interest to begin with, and later it's taking a little bit longer to come up with the money, so we come up with an arrangement that you'll pay me back $120. That's only an issur d'rabbanan. The only time it's asur midoraisa is when the original loan included a clause whereby you have to pay. But Chazal did add many situations where ribbis applies midrabbanan. An example would be a sale. Okay, this is very practical for people in business. My revered Rebbe and professor of economics, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who I think was a predecessor to Baruch Dov Braun as a rabbi of the Young Israel Avenue J. So he was the head of the economics department at Yeshiva College for, I don't know, many, many years. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham and a big, he's an economist, and, you know, he was an economist and a master of Choshen Mishpat. So he used to point out that people who deliver goods and accept payment on credit from their customers, you know, a vendor, it's common practice to have a price, you know, that you'll pay if you pay up front. And then another price that you'll pay, which is slightly higher if you don't pay on delivery, but you pay, within 30 days or so. Okay? And that, if it's a Jew supplying goods to another Jew, if it's not set up properly, that could be ribbis. Ribbis midrabbanan, because it's on a sale where you're paying back more than you received, you know, or you're extending that that credit for another month at a higher price. Okay, so that would be an issur d'rabbanan. So without going into any more details, it is conceivable, at least, that if Chazal added certain categories of ribbis midrabbanan where interest is a problem, it's also possible that there's certain situations where ribbis doesn't exist midrabbanan. They didn't institute ribbis on wages. Could be because it's not shchiach, it wasn't a common example, but that's his opinion. That opinion, I believe, we can call, as Rav Schefter likes to say, a collector's item, okay? The Beis Yosef says, for sure, we should never be somich on that at all. It does get honorable mention, but we don't pass him like that. So what could be...
Rabbi, generally, when a guy gets paid, it's sort of, you get paid a salary, but there's also other parts of the compensation that a person can get, right? So we're talking about, it's much more complicated in that situation, right? Somebody does a good job on a project, you wouldn't say, I can't give him $1,000 bonus because he worked extra hard on the project, right?
So, 100%, but that's not what we're talking about. We're saying Rabbi Elazar had a due date on Rabbi Akiva's wages, right? That was undisputed. He was supposed to deliver the money Erev Yom Kippur, and because I didn't give it to you Erev Yom Kippur, look, I came with a whole party, you know, with your money, and much more than I ever would have given you. Okay? So...
Right, but he still was a worker. He's still a worker-employee-employer relationship, you know, which might be considered different than the normal... You know, it's not a loan. He's just... He was working.
So that's the first suggestion. Could be that it doesn't have the status of a loan. The second shot is maybe similar to what you were saying, Mike, that Rabbi Yashiv suggests maybe it was common practice to give what we call hanukkah. The Torah says when you release an Eved Ivri, ha'anek ta'anek lo. You have to give him some extra, you know, what's the expression? You have to pack him for the road or whatever. You have to give him some animals, some food. You send them off with a bang. You know, you don't just say, okay, you're done. You know, kick him out on the street. You give him a little bit to get him back on his feet. So maybe this is the similar type of thing, that it was common practice to give a little bonus. And if that was the understanding and it wasn't Rivas, so then that would be okay, because he would have – this is the punchline. If he would have given it to him regardless, he's not just giving it to him because he was late on the payment. So, you know, so he wanted to make it up to him, then that would be justified. Because he was going to give it to him anyway. It was the holiday bonus that he gets even when his payment does come on time. Okay?
The way this story is presented, it seems as though there wasn't a set wage.
Well, 1 second.
I'll take this.
It
seems like...
That's qualitative. Quantitative... let's step back. I hear what you're saying. Quantitatively, the number was $1,000. The only question was how he was going to pay back. Which the halacha is... When it comes to what you use to pay back, it can really be anything that you have on hand. Meaning, if someone does damage to someone else and they don't have enough money to pay for the damages, then the injured party is obligated to accept whatever, you know, the damager is ready to give him, because that's all he's got.
The reason I'm saying that is, you know, if somebody worked for 3 years, you can imagine that it would be a considerable amount of money. Some cushions and things just doesn't seem to be able to add up to a fee that somebody would take for that amount of time.
You're right. The animals and the real estate would still owe Rabbi Akiva money if he wasn't able to produce, you know, these goods at the price that Rabbi Akiva. Oh, you're right. If you want to replace the word pillows and cushions with Persian rugs, or, you know, those are very nondescript. Again, Rabbi Elazar was a fabulously wealthy person. He may have had 1,000 pillows made out of silk that he could have given to Rabbi Akiva to make up the money. It was just, you know, Rabbi Akiva was just saying, anything you have, I'll take.
What happens if you owe somebody $100,000 and you can't pay it, and because of that he loses money on something?
Okay. That's Rabbi Yashiv's second answer. Very good. So what would we call that? Now, halacha, if I cause damage to someone indirectly, right? I didn't drive my car into your living room, okay? I did something indirect that caused you a loss. That's called grama, okay? So the Gemara says in Bava Kama that grama is pater bidei adam and chai bidei neshamayim. If I do damage you indirectly, you can't extract the money in court. The court can only extract money that I, a loss that I caused to you directly, okay? But the Gemara says bidei shamayim, I haven't fully, you know, gotten off the hook. In Shemayim, they're still expecting me to pay back because I caused something indirectly. Maybe I did it intentionally, but I still caused it indirectly. So maybe if my goal is to pay you back this extra money because you incurred some sort of unusual corollary, right? Let's say I owe you money, and because I didn't pay you back, you couldn't make your mortgage payment, and you got evicted, right? And as a result, you lost the whole house, right? So maybe, in a case like that, I'm not paying you the ribis, but I'm covering a loss that I indirectly caused. Very good. That's Rabbi Yashiv's second answer. Okay? Let's continue. So now, he's at Rabbi Akiva's house, and they're talking tachlis. He gives him all his money. Nasan lo scharo. Now he pays him the schar. Okay? I wonder why he didn't pay it to him up front. You know, if I was Rabbi Akiva and he comes and, you know, serves me a few drinks and, you know, gives me a hamburger, I might have been a little suspicious, you know, like, no, where's the money? That's what I've been waiting for, not for dinner, you know? Okay, but he was able to appease Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva enjoyed the meal. Amar lo, so now Rabbi Elazar puts him on the spot. And he says, B'shosha martali, tein li schari. When you said to me, okay, please give me my wages, and I told you I had no money. What did you suspect was the reason why I had no money? I thought maybe you had found some good merchandise cheap, and you took the money that you had, you took all your cash, and you invested it in, I don't know, bitcoins were low, and you wanted to get in cheap, okay? Not a great idea, all right? But you found some good merchandise and you invested it. The Sfas Emes points out over here that it's not by accident that the Gemara says that it was bezol. It was very cheap, right? Because there is, you know, forget about just being a good neighbor. There are specific prohibitions in the Torah against delaying paying a worker, right? It says, bal tolin, lo solin pulasad chir ad boker. When a worker finishes working for you, you have to pay him. You know, if he finishes at night, you have to pay him by the end of the night. If he finishes during the daytime, pay him by the end of that day. People don't know. This applies to a babysitter. If you hire a babysitter, watch your kids, and, you know, she watches the kids from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock at night, you are in violation of an Isser D'oraisa if you don't pay her that evening, okay, before sunrise, Losa Shachar, whatever. Now, to be fair, if you don't have any money on you, you can say, you know, please forgive me if you don't mind. You know, I gotta get some change. Can I bring the money tomorrow? And she says yes. Okay, so she can be mochel, she can accept it. But in the absence of any arrangement, it's a losa sedoraisa to delay payment. And there's also a positive mitzvah, biyomo titin skoro. I remember there's a certain barber that his barbershop is about a block or two away from the yeshiva I learned in Israel, in Yerushalayim. And all the guys in Shiva would go and get their haircuts there. And literally, you know, in the last 15, 20 years, long after I finished yeshiva, I always, when I'm in Israel, you know, I'll go an extra 2 weeks, you know, and I'll let my hair grow a little bit longer so that I can get my hair cut by Avner. He's world famous. Okay, so Avner and many barbers in Yerushalayim have a sign on their wall that lists all the, I don't know, dozen and a half mitzvahs you can get by getting a haircut al pi halacha, following the right, you know, not cutting your pay, it's not like this, like that, you know, all the different rules. You know, always joke about the fact that in a non-Jewish, whatever, salon, hairstylist, you know, they have a poster with, you know, 18 pictures of what you can cut your hair like, you know, this angle, that angle, you know. But in a frum barbershop, they have the same poster with, you know, a guy facing in 18 different ways about how you shouldn't cut your hair, you know. But so Avner has a sign in his barbershop where it lists all the mitzvos you can perform, and one of them is paying him on time, you know. But and also making sure not to delay. V'chalta v'savata v'erachta v'shilamta, as it says at the exit to Shimon's Pizza. Okay, all right. So the Achronim ask, How could a Rebbe Elazar get away with delaying the payment? It's an Isser D'oraisa. And even if you'll tell me, look, it is true, if you have no cash, maybe you're a putter, but Rebbe Akiva should have thought ahead, right? You have to have a little foresight to think that I'm going to spend all my money, but I owe this worker who's been working for the last 3 years. So the Sfas Emes suggests maybe there's a special kula if it's prakmacha bezol, if it's an unusual metzia, that if I don't buy it right now, on Erev Yom Kippur, you know, similar to what we were saying before, when the price is super low, you know, then I'm going to lose this price and I won't be able to get it, you know, at a later date. So maybe I have permission to invest all my money in that merchandise, even though I have an impending debt, when it's an unusual mitzvah. We have, you know, we have many situations where Dover Havid, Chol HaMoed, there's dispensations for doing business on Chol HaMoed. During Avelos, there's dispensations for Dover Havid. Okay.
So you would think that there would be maybe an obligation for the employer, in this case, to speak to Rabbi Akiva and tell him, listen, I'm in a situation where I may make a bunch of money, and perhaps tie him into the situation saying, I'm investing in a bunch of stuff here, because otherwise, you know, he put himself in a situation where he can't pay his employee. He has an obligation right to employ. Normal situation, you'd say, listen, I'm going to run out of money here, and I hope to give you more, you know, more money than I owe, which probably isn't ribbis because he assumes a risk, but maybe it is. And it gets complicated. You would think there might be some obligation to discuss it with the employee, because you know, it's almost, it seems like he's, you know, what lawyers sometimes get in trouble with. They have money in escrow where they dip their hand in the till to use it for something and put it back. It seems to, right? I understand, but he has money.
That's not legal. That, you know, you're saying you should have given Rabbi Akiva a heads up. You know, there should have been some communication. Right. So 100%. Unless this all went down, you know, that morning, Erev Yom Kippur. I'm not sure, but it's a good question. Okay, so Shema Prakamachi Bezol Nizdam Lach. The Lacha Behen. I figure maybe some unbelievable deal came up and you had to use all your money for that. And when you said to me, okay, at least give me some animals. Vamarti ain li behema. And I said, I had no animals. You know, come on. I'm a rich guy. Bamecha Sharatani, what do you think, what do you think was going on? Amarti Shemel is Keres Berachirim. I figured maybe you had a business where you rented all your animals out to other people so that they could use them for their, you know, on their farms and on their, for their business. Bishosha Martali Tainli Karka. And what about when you said to me, okay, at least give me some real estate. Amarti Lacha, Bamarti Lacha Tainli Karka. I said, I don't have any land. Bamecha Sharatani, you know, come on, you've been working here for all these years on my land, right? So what does it mean I don't have any karka? So b'mechas aratani, amarti shema mucheres b'arachirim hi. I thought maybe you had taken your land and you had done chachira. Chachira is a deal by which, I'm not sure what, if we have an English word for it, not sharecropping.
Sharecropper?
Not exact. Sharecropper is what we call an aris, where we have a deal that you will work for, you know, such and such a number of years, and you'll give me 70% of the crops and you'll keep 30% of the crops. Chachira is where you basically lease the field and you get 100% profits, but it still belongs to me. It's a lease, that's all, okay?
It's more of a rental deal.
Okay, okay. So you can use the field for whatever you want, but bottom line, the Baal Bais didn't have control over the field to give it away to Rabbi Kiva. V'shor shamarti l'cha ein li peiros. And what about when I said to you that I have no fruit? B'mecha sharetani. You know, what were you thinking then? Amarti shema ein musaros. I thought maybe you had fruit, because I knew you had fruit, but you had not separated truma and meiser. And it was Erev Yom Kippur, and you didn't have time to go, run all over the place and separate trumas and meisers. And it's even worse. Rabbi Akiva, at this point, like we said, this is before he was Rabbi Akiva, it's usher to give an amaret, someone who is not learned, something that is untithed, because you don't have any guarantee that the person who receives it is going to do what he's supposed to do with it. Okay.
Doesn't the Gemara give us eights if you run into such a circumstance? You could again, the northern part of this is this, and this comes up here.
Right.
So
I think that could work if you had like a plate of food or you had a barrel of wine. Right, so all those examples, were viable. But apparently, this is, he had all of his stuff, everything he owned. It would not have been so practical. And even then, one second, does that always work? Does that always work? It still requires you to physically separate. Meaning, I don't know if any of you have ever separated trumas and maestros nowadays. It happens sometimes, When I was overseeing the kashrus in Washington Heights, so every once in a while, by accident, as Zionistic as we like to be, we had to instruct the stores not to order produce from Israel. And it's usually not something they do intentionally. They have suppliers, they have distributors who bring them produce, bring them fruits and vegetables. And occasionally, just like in Costco, they can have some Jaffa oranges or peppers from somewhere in Israel. So we have to recommend that they don't do it because we couldn't guarantee that it would be dealt with properly by the owner of the store, who doesn't really have experience dealing with Truma and Meiser and when Shemitah comes around. But every once in a while, I actually in camp also, when I was in Camp Lavi, so one time they delivered a 50-pound bag of carrots from Israel, and they'd already started making soup with it. So we caught it in time, Baruch Hashem. But it's a process, and even when you do that, you have to remove some of the Truma and Meister that you're separating that can't be eaten even after you do this process. I mean, it's not totally magic. The question is, I think what you're referring to is, sometimes with the rules of Breira, you can leave a little bit at the end and say that was the Truma to, all along. It doesn't always work. It's complicated. So
a number of Gemaras like this.
Yeah, I think they're all based on the same Mishnah, but that Mishnah is quoted in different places. But it's not so simple to do. It's easy on a small scale. It's not so easy if you are a big landowner with all these things. I think. I think that that's what the Achronim say, that the justification was that he could not give it to Rabbi Kiva and have it all prepared and ready for him in time. Okay?
Israeli produce doesn't come with a certificate of some sort that says that Trumas and Masra was...
Great question. Great question. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes yes. The Rabbanut does have a system where they try to separate trumas and meisers on everything that gets exported, but you know, it's not ideal. It's not really the way that anyone would recommend you do it in your own home. It's sort of like
I worked for Nevada Rabbinic Queens.
Yes.
Okay, and it's very rare. There's very, very, very few importers that we accept. What they say was actually not very few.
Because that's it.
It has to be on campus.
Yeah,
there's very few because they're not. It's not a reliable system.
Right.
So it would be nice if the Rabbanut or Badatz or somebody, you know, that would be interested in giving the Jews in the diaspora a chance to partake of Israeli produce.
It depends how much money they can make off of it.
One second. Before we get too cynical, I'm sure the Rabbanut would love to help. But if you are a secular Israeli farmer and you have an opportunity to export your vegetables without taking any trumas and maisers, you know, that could be very profitable for you.
Israel does a lot of export.
I'm
located at a Chinese, I don't know if you know a place, a chosen village in Great Neck. So we buy from Chinese distributors for fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Many
also?
No. The Vatican of Queens does not allow a mashkiach or the Rabbanut itself to do any of this stuff at all. Completely not. So anything that comes, so every once in a while they try to sneak in something, some peppers like you're talking about, or carrots, and I just reject the orders.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's from Israel.
That's the policy. It's not impossible to deal. Every once in a while I get a phone call, Rabbi, I accidentally, you know, came home from Costco with this, you know, bag of peppers, what do I do? And it's not too complicated to fix it. If you look at an art school sitter, you know, the Yitzchak Yoyer sitter that we have here, after Shacharis, there's instructions. It's not so complicated. But
the Queen's doesn't allow that.
Unless, even though it's not complicated, if you haven't been educated, it's just not worth the trouble. It's not worth the possibility to make a mistake.
That's what Rabbi Akiva thought. That's what he said. Too complicated.
I don't think it's just about of Queens. I think that's a pretty standard, you know, kosher agencies try to keep things as simple as possible. Okay, so he said, Rabbi Akiva said...
I remember back in Yeshiva, we were told to put up 2 half-liras on our locker door, and then if we went into a bakery or something we weren't sure of, we should rip off the corner, take out the little paper that you wrote on for Chumas and Maizos, and you say it there, and you can eat the rest of the bagel or whatever.
Okay.
And then hopefully after 50 times, you remember to switch it over from 1 half-lira to the other half-lira.
There you go. There you go. Rabbi Willig has a coin that he publicly announces anyone can redeem their Meister Sheni on his coin. And here's the catch, which maybe they didn't teach you in Yeshiva. There's another halacha, and this is where the average mashgiach may not encounter this. You can do, as you said, keep redeeming Meister Sheni that you separate on a coin. You know, wherever that coin doesn't have to be in front of you. It could be somewhere else. It could be in Rabbi Willig's house. But there is a mitzvah d'oraisa, at least in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, that we read about at the beginning of Parshas Kisavo, Vidoy Maestros, that every 3 years, right? Biarti HaKodesh Min HaBayis, Vo Biarti Mimenu Bitamei, right? Vasati Mimenu Lemeis, right? So that's all declaration you make, certifying that you have removed all pending meiser from your house, everything that you separated, you know, and your in order to make the food that you had previously you had an issue with permitted, and that coin needs to be destroyed. Now it needs to be destroyed because we have no way of using it in the way that it was intended to be used. So it used to be you threw it into the river, and no one would ever see it again. In the last number of years, Rabbi Willig, twice a year, goes to the 14th floor of Belfer Hall in on the campus of YU, where they have the chemistry lab, and together with the chemistry professor, it escapes me right now the name of the chemical. It has some, some oxide, okay, you know, some very, very...
to destroy currency?
So Rabbi Willig, every time he does it, explains why. I think he asked the government official, and that he said they're not machmir, but he addressed that. He definitely addressed that. I forget what the reason is. I'll let you know. Somewhere I have a video of him doing this. Every year they count, you know, to see how fast it takes for the coin to totally disintegrate in the acid. But if I can dig up the video, I'll be happy to share it with you. Okay?
Have you ever been in a fruit store in Israel where they come to take fruits and ices?
I don't know if I was ever there when it happened. Maybe once. Yes, why?
My son was in Ramat Eshkol. It's interesting. He comes, and they have everything separated. So, like, the one that's smart first, he already did over here. The apples are all right. You don't take the oranges. He didn't do anything yet. Keep away from the oranges. It's very interesting.
Yeah, you got to know your stuff. You got to know your stuff.
Yeah.
Remind me, I'll throw out an idea on that note as we conclude. Let's just try to make it a little bit further over here. So basically what's happening is that every time, you know, they're replaying the story, and Rabbi Akiva had some sort of dan lekav zchus, some sort of, you know, excuse by which he was able to judge the Baal HaBayis favorably. What about b'shosh amarti l'chaim l'kar m'ksos? When I told you I don't even have any pillows or any blankets, b'mecha sharetani, what do you think? Amarti shema hikdish kol nechassel l'shamayim. I figured the only way to explain it was that you had consecrated all of your belongings to make it holy for the Beis HaMikdash. Amar leh, Rabbi Elazar said back to him, ha'avoda. Avoda is an expression of an oath. I swear by the avoda or whatever. Kachaya. That's exactly what happened. Every single point that you conjured up in your head, that's exactly what happened. Even that last one.
What are the odds of that happening?
Kachaya yidarti kol nechassai b'shvil horkenes b'ni shalasek b'torah. My son Horkenes, I don't know, he was getting older and he wasn't learning. He never went to yeshiva. He wasn't successful. And I told him pretty much, I'm taking out of the will. I'm going to make all of my possessions. And he was a very wealthy man. I'm going to make it, belong to the Beis HaMikdash. You're going to get nothing until you go to learn in yeshiva. Shabasi, it's a chaver b'darom, hitiruli kol nidarai. And when I went to my friends in the south, they were matir neder for me. Apparently, it was successful. Horkenes got the hint and went to study in yeshiva. And then he gave Rabbi Akiva bracha. Kishem shadan tanu l'zchus hamakom yodin oscha l'zchus. Just as you judge me favorably, so too I bless you that Hashem should judge you favorably as well. Hamakom, hamakom yodin oscha l'zchus.
Should we say that worked out very well for Rabbi Akiva?
So Rabbi Akiva, it's interesting. Rabbi Akiva, you see from here, he had very exceptional midos even before he was a Talmud Chacham. Okay, which, if you look in the Gemara in Ksubis, when it tells the story of Rabbi Akiva that we're more familiar with, that was why Rachel, the daughter of Kalba Savua, married him. She said, I will marry you if you go off to learn, because I recognize that you have unique midos. And, this also, this ties into Lag BaOmer, because Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim, who died because they didn't have perfect Derech Eretz, so it wasn't necessarily that it was a punishment, right? Because this is all, everyone asked, Rabbi Aaron Cutler asked, even if they didn't have the best Derech Eretz, but that means they should all die? That sounds like a little bit extreme, right? So it's not the pshat that it was a punishment consequences. The pshat is like this. Rabbi Akiva was the father of the Mesorah in his generation, right? Ultimately, it was his Talmidim who wrote the Brisas and the Toseftas and everything else that came afterwards. Rabbi Akiva was the key link in taking Torah Shabbal Peh, for eternity. And if the qualities of Yerushalayim and proper midos are more than just good things to have in your portfolio, they're absolutely necessary for Torah to thrive. They're absolutely pivotal for, to incubate the Torah inside of a person's neshama, for it to flower and blossom the way it's supposed to. It needs to be incubated in the soil of midos. And they didn't have it. So Rabbi Akiva, it's not surprising, his wife Rachel recognized that he had those qualities, which are evidenced by the story, that ultimately put Rabbi Akiva on the path to be successful when he went to learn for 24 years in yeshiva. I just want to add one halacha lamaisa. The Rambam, this whole story, this whole principle of Dan Lekav Zchus, judging people favorably, comes from the Mishnah in Perkei Avos, Perek Aleph Mishnah Vav. I'll share it on the screen for you. Right? Yoshua ben Prachya v'nitai ha'arbeli kiblu mehem. The next generation of the Zugos and the Sanhedrin, the leaders of the generation, sorry, the Abezdin and the Benasi was Yoshuv and Prachin Nitai Bailey. Kiblu Mehem. They accepted from the previous leaders. Yoshuv and Prachin Omer, Aseilach Rav, Uknelach Chaver. First, he said you have to have a Rebbe for yourself, and you have to endeavor to make a good friend. Vavidan is called Adam Kapsuchos. You have to judge everyone. So, interesting, everyone. So, notice the Rambam makes a point. I think the gears over here, Avidan is called Ha'adam. Ha'adam doesn't mean all people. It means the entire person. I mean, you have to look, you know, at where a person's coming from, what's in their background, what are their unique, circumstances. That helps you judge a person favorably and give them the benefit of the doubt when you're more understanding than only looking at their actions and their words on the surface. But both the Rambam and Rabbeinu Yonah and their commentaries on the Mishnah provide us with a halacha l'maisa takeaway. Because if you think about it, why are they telling this in Pirkei Avos? This is a pasuk in the Torah. Pasuk in the Torah says, "Betzedek tishpor es amisecha." You should judge your friend favorably, right? So what? Like, why is it such a big deal? I have a great piece of advice for you. Have a rebbe, have a friend, and judge people favorably. What do you mean? I have to. That's a chiv midoraisa. So not so fast. Yes and no. Explains Rabbeinu Yonah. Zem medaber im adam she'en yodim bo im hutzadik v'im hurasha. When are we being told to judge a person favorably? So if you don't really know the qualities of this person, maybe a tzadik, maybe a rasha, im akir noso v'u ish beinoni, pamim osa ra, pamim osa tov. Let's say you have an average person. Sometimes he does the right thing, sometimes he does the wrong thing. Miasa davar she'eshal duno l'kav chova, v'eshal duno l'zchus, b'shikol, if it's a 50-50 split. The circumstances are such that it could be this way, it could be that way. Or it even is, 60-40. It looks a little more in direction of negative, mishum tzad inyan, based on the circumstances. And based on the circumstances, you can judge him favorably. You should try to give him the benefit of the doubt. But this is not true when it comes to a tzadik gomer or a rasha gomer. The notion of down the kafskos as a general principle is when it's 50-50. Okay? But if a tzadik, I feel the maisa shekulo ra venota lekafchova, mikol ever yidunei letova. If you see a tzadik do something wrong, even if there's no mistaking, you have no explanation possibly for anything that he's done, in a positive light, you should still judge him favorably. Must have been an accident. Something must have slipped his mind. There's no way to hold him responsible. And on the flip side, he says that if you see a Russia, someone who's known to be a bad person, and he does something which looks entirely good, you should judge him and be suspect that he has some ulterior motives and he's not 100% out there for the good. Interesting. So what we're left with is we don't really know. We don't really know 50-50. That's where we're being told. Dan is called Avnu Kapsuchos. The Chiddush of Rebbe Kiva is, and perhaps in order for one to merit this special quality of Hashem judging you favorably, it's not enough to just fulfill the Torah's mitzvah. I'm suggesting. Not enough to fulfill the Torah's mitzvah of B'tzedek Tishpor Es Amisecha, but to merit Hashem should judge you favorably as well, to the extent Rebbe Kiva had it, you need to even go to the furthest extreme, even when it seems so unlikely. But there's still, evidently, there's still a milo. There's still, it's not considered crazy. It's not considered reckless to still try to find some sort of positive explanation for what he did. As we see in the story, and we don't have time for it tonight, but the Gemara is going to have a few more stories that are going to follow the same theme. Okay?
This seems to fit well into what we do in Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, and how the Benanim are judged, and how somebody, how all of the judgment by Kadosh Baruch Hu takes place.
Benani gets a little more time. His judgment is not sealed.
I understand. So, but exactly what you're talking about here, Hashem apparently judges us during that period of time. If we're on the wrong side of the scale, we're right. In trouble.
Correct.
Right. But what's interesting is that the topic, the sugya is talking about the Kaladam Lakav Schut, and they say it's only the Beinoni, but if in fact it was the Tana Rav Elezer Ben Horkana, so it wouldn't really be Dan Lakav Schut, because he's saying you would fall into the category of a tzaddik. So
right.
It wouldn't need that extra benefit of the doubt. Of course it's him. So he had to do it.
Okay, that's a good point.
Seems like a funny example.
It's a good point. I wonder if there is some, part of the reason why he is not named. At least we only find out about him at the end to, his son Hyrcanus.
Right.
But he's left anonymous. Is that to teach us something? I believe the Maharal says, notwithstanding what we saw from Rabbeinu Yonah in terms of the halacha, it seems that there still is a milah whenever possible to go as, even if it's going to go, far out there, but you should try to find Kazakhs. There's a, Rav Shachter always says, his grandchildren who live in Israel, he has a few children who live in Eretz Yisrael. He said, if you walk together with them on Shabbos, a Friday night, and they see a car driving in the distance, they'll say, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. He said, why are you saying Mazel Tov? Someone's on the way to the hospital to give birth. Mazel Tov. There is something to be said about making sure, again, it could be true, it could be not true, but in order not to let our sense of sanctity for Shabbos to be eroded, to be down the kavschos, that whatever it is that we're witnessing is actually something positive and something appropriate.
Right. Although the story you told about Rav Shechter, where he was told that he could go, his father told him he could go to Simchas.
Yeah.
He might be an Avelis, but people would say blah blah blah. But if he's supposed to be with a tzaddik, you're supposed to always assume.
Yeah.
You turn around and say, well, you don't have to worry about that, because people would say there's no way Rav Shechter would do something that.
I think people just don't necessarily know this halacha. I think we discussed on the Moed Katan Shiur, we once spoke about the tshuva that Ramosha wrote because that lady called him up and gave him muster that he was driving to shul Friday night after candlelighting time, right? Not everyone knows. There's that one of the classic questions is, why is there a principle of Maris Ayin?
Right.
It looks like I'm doing something wrong, but you're supposed to judge me favorably. Okay, but people don't. It's a challenge. It's a challenge.
So, Rabbi, the little mantra you gave to Mircha Marv at Irving's house was about this topic. And Irving's in the shir. I don't know if you know that, but Irving's in the shir. So he got to learn about Lakav Schut, even though he's not at the shir.
Okay. Okay.
We covered the subject yesterday.
All right, so please, I'll share the recording. If anyone who's usually here wants to listen, I record on my phone. Okay.